From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For the past 2 years, researchers based at UC Davis have been studying political violence through the lens of public health. Since 2022, their series of studies have taken a wide canvas looking at the population as a whole, but also specifically at how political affiliation and other ideologies shape one's support and willingness for political violence. Their latest study published this morning, and it looks at whether there's a link between firearm owners and political violence. This research is groundbreaking because nearly 30 years ago, Congress prevented federal funding for gun violence research. It's known as the 1996 Dickey Amendment, which means for a long time, there's been little funding went to understanding as well as preventing it. The tide has turned recently in years to view gun violence as a public health crisis. The California Firearm Violence Research Center, it's based at UC Davis, and it's the nation's first publicly funded research center to understand the nature of firearm violence and its underlying causes. Dr. Garen Wintemute is the director of the center. He is also an emergency physician and joins us with the findings from their latest study. Good afternoon, Dr. Wintemute.
Afternoon. Thanks for having me.
What prompted this series of research looking at political violence through the lens of public health?
Trends in gun purchasing. As the pandemic approached us in late 2019, early 2020, we were expecting gun purchasing to go way up because people are scared and they buy guns. And it did. But then it stayed up right through 2020, a federal election year. But then in 2021, it didn't really decrease back to the normal. And we wondered what's going on here and started exploring and learned that, as one counterterrorism expert put it about the January 6th event, lots of people wanted to see that as the end of something. The experts saw it as the beginning of something. So we started designing some surveys, did one in 22 that we'll talk about today, did one in 2023, and we're gearing up for one this year.
Mm. Before we dive into this latest study that was published this morning, there have been a handful that have published since 2022. What have been the biggest takeaways when you take them as a whole?
To be honest, the biggest takeaway is a hopeful finding that we ask people in these surveys, do you think political violence is justified in general? And if not in general, how about for this cause and this cause and this cause? Long list of reasons. And if people think it's justified, we then ask them, so are you willing to do it yourself? And the main takeaway, to be honest, is that the vast majority of people reject political violence over and over and over again in these surveys. And the vast majority of people who say, well, you know, maybe it's justified, go on to say, but I wouldn't want to do it myself. The focus today and in some of these other studies is on the subsets of people who don't follow the rule that I just laid out. The people who say, no, I think political violence is justified for lots of circumstances, and yes, I would be willing to do it. We ask people, would you kill somebody? And people, some of them say, yes, I would.
So this latest study that we're going to talk about, it was a natural progression from the previous studies that you've done.
Yes, it was. We designed the survey to look at a bunch of possible risk factors all at once, and firearm ownership and use was one of the things we wanted to look at.
When it comes to the background of why this research is important, because, you know, for decades, there's been little funding devoted to this, you know, why is the timing of this research so important? Because it really spans from 2022 to 2024.
Yep. As I said, we got started during the pandemic, but experts see a real potential for violence being used to reshape the future of the country, to overthrow the democratic process. We study violence, we study gun violence in particular. There was an obvious nexus there, and we decided we need to take this on because somebody needs to find out what's going on.
So this study is called Firearm Ownership and Support for Political Violence in the United States. It is a national survey. How did you accomplish this, if you can explain some of the methodology?
Sure. We used an existing research panel. It's run by a proprietary company named Ipsos. They use what's called an address-based sampling process to recruit a sample of people who are representative of the population of the United States. These people sign up to take surveys. If they don't have access to the internet, they are given equipment so that they have access to the internet. Lots of time and effort spent to get a high quality sample. So we used that as our framework. We wanted detailed information about firearm owners, so we recruited what's called an oversample of firearm owners so that we can get really precise answers.
What surprised you most with the findings?
I think, to be honest, the surprise was the bad news. How willing some subsets of firearm owners are to endorse and be involved in political violence. But before I get to that, I should say another surprise was there was actually, and this is good news, relatively speaking, little difference between firearm owners in general as a whole and non-owners in general in their support for political violence or their willingness to engage in it. So that rule that I mentioned kind of right at the beginning sort of applied, but the money's in the subsets.
Right, and those subsets are certain types of firearm owners. It would be people who purchased firearms recently, the type of firearm that they purchase, as well as whether they carry their firearm with them regularly or frequently. Let's dive into the gun purchases that took place during the pandemic, the recent purchases. What did you learn about this subset and a willingness, or at least a willingness to support political violence?
Yep. So these are people who bought at least one gun during the pandemic years. And we asked them, as we asked everybody, is political violence justified in a bunch of different circumstances? Would you be engaged in political violence yourself? What would you do? Would you threaten somebody? Would you shoot somebody? Would you kill somebody? And what we found for those recent purchasers is they were more likely to endorse political violence conceptually than other owners were, and they were more willing to engage in violence themselves, including lethal violence.
Why does the type of firearm matter?
So it wasn't generally the type of firearm. We focused specifically on people who told us that they owned at least one assault-type rifle. That's the type of, that's of interest here. For the, I think, obvious reason, firearm is a tool. If I'm going to use a tool in mass violence, I want, to be honest, an assault-type rifle because I can put a lot of lead down range, as they say, with that weapon. So we compared people who owned at least one assault-type rifle to everybody else. And what we found there was assault rifle owners were more willing to endorse political violence than owners of other types of firearms, but they were not more willing to engage in it themselves, at least as they told us on the survey.
Was that surprising to you?
I expected the two to go together. So yes, it was surprising. I'm a little skeptical. I don't want to take away from the validity of the responses we got, but those same owners told us they were very, very likely to show up armed in a situation where they thought political violence was justified. And we've seen lots of instances of people showing up armed in that kind of a setting. And then it's tough. You've got the weapon not to use it. But I want to take what they said at face value because I'm trying to be hopeful about the results. Mm.
The last one was about individuals who carry firearms in public. What did you learn about this subset?
Yes. It's important to say for a California audience that in much of the country, it's legal to carry a gun without a permit, or you can get a permit just by asking. That's not the situation here. But in much of the rest of the country, it's very common to see people walking around strapped up, as they say, in public. Those people who do that, as they told us, all the time or nearly all the time, accounted for about 10% of the firearm owners in our survey. But they were far more willing to endorse political violence. More than half of them, 60% of them, said it was justified, at least in some of the specific situations that we gave. But the thing that concerned me the most was they're willing to engage in it. Of those regular carriers, nearly 10% said that they would be very or completely willing to shoot somebody to advance a political objective.
And when we're talking about this, I mean, we're talking about endorsing, supporting political violence, but then there's also the willingness to participate in political violence. What stands out to you about the difference between these two?
I think this is a really important distinction as we look down the road. On the one hand, I'm really glad that there are lots of people who aren't willing to commit political violence given that they endorse it. The downside, the glass half empty, is that a climate of acceptance of political violence by people who aren't willing to engage in it themselves may make it easier for those people who are willing to go ahead and do it. To be honest, what I'm hoping is that the people who aren't willing to engage in it themselves can be, if you will, pulled back from the cliff a little bit, reduce their support and help become and become part of an effort to turn down the rhetoric and disengage us from political violence.
You touched upon this just briefly. Can you be sure people are being honest, especially when they're answering, would you engage in political violence with a firearm?
Sure. This is a question that's appropriately asked of every single survey that's done on a controversial topic. And pretty much everything we asked about was controversial. Let me summarize. Researchers themselves, survey researchers, have been very interested in the question, are people telling us the truth? So, especially on things like this. So they've structured, we did not do this, but others have structured surveys where they ask people to tell them about things they have or haven't done, but they have access to external information on whether people got arrested, for example, or something like that. And it turns out, even when the information is controversial and might put the respondent in a bad light, they tend to tell the truth. So I tend to believe people on surveys.
What other limitations are there to this study?
The data are, as we say, cross-sectional, all gathered in one point in time. So we can't say that any one thing is causally related to anything else that we found. They simply coexist. We don't know about the relationship. We're going to be working on that. The other is, it's a big sample. There are almost 13,000 people in the survey, but that's still 13,000 people whose responses we are using to represent the opinion of 250 million adults. There's always error in that kind of measurement, and we measure the extent of that potential error, but that's not the same thing as saying it isn't there.
Yeah. Well, research isn't meant to just stay in an academic journal. It's meant to go somewhere to shape policy or to affect change, prevention in this case. Who are the stakeholders who you want most to look at this research?
Thank you for that question. I have to say, policymakers can do some things with this information. Prevention people can do some things with this information. It can help guide prevention efforts. But to be honest, what I'm really hoping is that this study, the other studies that we've put out, the study we have coming out next week on civil war, will provide sort of a wake-up call so that the general public, which to be honest is my primary audience, will understand there's the potential for a real problem here. And if I myself as an individual don't do something about it, that potential might become realized and we could be facing mass violence later this year, or even without mass violence, violent efforts to overthrow the political process.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Garen Wintemute with the California Firearm Violence Research Center. It's based at UC Davis, about their latest research into whether there's a link between firearm ownership and political violence. In the last few minutes that we have, I'd love for you to just remind us of your background as an ER doctor and how this ultimately led to you becoming a researcher in violence prevention overall, but also including gun violence.
Sure. My entire career, I've been interested in what's called refocusing upstream, looking at the flow of events that bring people through the doors of the emergency department. There's only so much we can do once people are sick or injured and they come to the department. The idea is, how can we intervene in that flow of events and prevent that emergency from developing in the first place? I chose to focus on violence. And in the United States, gun violence was it was the gorilla in the room. It was the huge part of violence that nobody was willing to study. There was no money. There was organized opposition. It was risky. And to be honest, to me, all of those were attractants. I was, okay, let's go for it. And I've been doing it for the last 40 years. The same thing happened with this. We saw kind of a signal on the horizon, if you will, in this really anomalous gun purchasing trend, followed our noses and discovered we're onto something.
Mm-hmm. Since the 1996 Dickey Amendment, which I briefly touched upon before we started our conversation, does that essentially mean that we as a country were playing catch up in understanding the root causes and hopefully prevention of gun violence?
Yes, sadly so. For about 20 years, there was essentially no funding. And my rhetorical question is, how many people are dead today who would be alive if we had answered 20 or 30 years ago the questions that we're answering now, not about political violence specifically, but about gun violence in general. But there is a happy side even to this story. Jay Dickey, whose name was given to that amendment, the congressman who, in his words, was spokesperson for the point man for the NRA on this, had a change of heart, recognized he'd made a mistake, lobbied for funding for research. And when the California legislature was considering establishing our center, Jay Dickey wrote a letter saying you should do this.
I think it's also important to remember, and I always am reminded of this when I talk with you, when I was looking at numbers for gun violence deaths over the years from the Pew Research Center, 2021 saw the highest total number of gun deaths in the country. The rate, though, because the country has grown in population, it remained below its peak level. I mean, slightly below the peak level, very slightly below the peak level. But there was a sharp rise during the pandemic of gun-related deaths. And that it was actually suicides. Suicides lead both the highest number and the highest rate of gun deaths in the country.
Yes. I just want to come back to that word slightly. It was just barely. Did we have higher rates in the 1990s than we did just in the last couple of years? Both homicide and suicide went up in different years, but we saw the largest, both in percentage terms and absolute number terms, increases in homicide and suicide that we've ever seen during the pandemic. Suicide is the part of firearm death about which we really don't have a story. It's not covered in the media. People don't like to talk about it if it's happened in their family because it's sort of a source of shame and sadness. So we don't have that story. The importance of this, among many other things, is the demographics of suicide turn people's understanding of firearm violence upside down. The group at high risk for firearm suicide is not young men of color, it's elderly, white, non-Hispanic men. And if you look at numbers but not rates of deaths, beginning in the mid-30s of age, so about age 35, for men, first a plurality and as age advances, finally a very large majority of the people who die from gun violence in the United States are white men. Everybody has skin in this game.
And this is my last question. After hearing that, you know, you do use the word hope multiple times in this conversation. How do you still continue to go back to that?
It's based on evidence. I'll give you one brief example. California, in the late 1980s, when I got started, had rates of gun violence death that were far higher than they were in the rest of the country. We turned on a dime. With some mass shootings and other things, we enacted a whole series of fairly strict regulations of firearm ownership and use. The result over time is that even with the upset during the pandemic, the rate of firearm violence death in the rest of the United States is more than 60% higher than it is in California. Until the pandemic sort of upset the apple cart everywhere, through the entire 21st century, gun violence rates had been decreasing in California and going up in the rest of the country. I know that prevention works. We are living it here.
Dr. Wintemute, as always, thank you.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Garen Wintemute is an emergency physician and the director of the California Firearm Violence Research Center. It's based at UC Davis. And we've been talking about their latest research. It was just published this morning into whether there is a link between firearm ownership and political violence. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio, where facts matter and stories inspire. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.